Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded Plus podcast. Now the Rugby Union World Cup is over, I thought we'd take a look at the future of the game with the second part of my interview with Michael Aylwin, the Rugby Union correspondent of The Guardian. In part one, which you can listen to in episode 80 of Rugby Reloaded, we discuss Mike's new book, Unholy Union, When Rugby Collided with the Modern World, which is written with Mark Evans, the former chief executive of Harlequins and the Melbourne Storm. That episode looked at where rugby union stands today, and so this week's episode looks at the future of the code. We began by discussing whether the English Premiership was too slavishly copying the business model of soccer.
We refer to football in the book as the sibling, global rugby's big problem is that its two biggest markets, England and France, are set in cultures, particularly in England, where football is king and it's a way of life. And football is the only sport in the world where the professionals at the top are lumped in the same seamless structure with the amateurs at the very, very bottom. The only other places where that happens are rugby in England and rugby in France. And that is becoming increasingly a problem. The old relegation promotion debate has been a long-standing one, as long as professionalism has existed in the union. I think it's increasingly clear now that there's got to be a cutoff, because this ethos, the professional ethos, does just seep throughout the structure. You only need one club to think, you know, Premiership's only a couple of leagues away, let's go for it. And they start paying their players when they shouldn't. Other clubs start losing their players and thinking, well, we've got to pay our players now, otherwise we can't compete anymore. And so the whole toxic culture seeps into the rest of the community game, which really should be something else, something separate. The facility that it provides for kids, boys and girls, for teenagers, is so precious, so valuable. Even the facility it provides for adults, that is jeopardized by clubs who think that they fancy a charge up the leagues to reach the Premiership. I mean, do they really think that reaching a Premiership is A, realistic, B, even just a good idea? I would contend the gap between now the finances of the Championship, which is a wasteland of overexpenditure and terrible strains.
Leeds Carnegie is a good example of that over the last few months.
Absolutely. I mean, there are so many examples of people who've, either on the way up in a hopeful rise to the Premiership, or even more poignantly on the way down, having had a tilt at it. Everyone will say Exeter, and certainly Exeter are the shining example of what can be done. But Exeter are in a unique situation. I mean, quite apart from the £12 million windfall they got for selling their old ground to developers, which obviously helped finance the construction of Sandy Park. And having your own stadium is an absolutely priceless advantage in club rugby. They were strategically perfectly positioned. I mean, if the Premiership had wanted to open a new club and could have chosen where, they couldn't have picked a much better place than Exeter, the gateway to the one
area
of rugby that is out and out rugby mad, the far southwest. Strategically, it was the right place to go. They also happened to have that handy windfall, and they've certainly, since that, manipulated all that to their advantage very, very skillfully. And they're a wonderful example for what can happen. But they are also the exception that proves the rule. I mean, if you're someone who plays in the cricket outfield of a cricket pitch in Kew, and you think, why don't we go for the Premiership, even though we were actually only the fourth best team in the Championship when they managed to play their way through to the top, i.e. London Welsh, I just can't. It's so unnatural to try and wrench yourself out from your spiritual home, which is plainly not equipped for Premiership rugby, and try to plonk yourself somewhere, anywhere. It doesn't really matter where. Let's go for Oxford. And Oxford just happened to be at the time in the Thames Valley where Wasps were, where London Irish were, and they were all fighting for each other's fans anyway. It plainly isn't going to work, and it didn't. And London Welsh, you know, we all know what happened after that. They ended up having to go back to the beginning. And but they are a fabulous community club.
It's the fool's gold that everybody wants glory in sport, and if your pockets are deep enough, you think you can buy that. But, you know, by and large, it takes a lot more and a lot of objective factors to be in place before you can even think about that, regardless of how rich the club's owner is.
And if Mark were here now, he'd be getting very exercised over this. Mark Evans, my co-author. He will, till he's blue in the face, make the point. Because obviously one of the counter-arguments is, well, you know, if you're saying we close the Premiership and that's that, those 12 or 13 or however many clubs it happens to be are it, then how do you grow the game? How do you let anyone else in? Well, his argument would be, and it's absolutely bang on, that is the only way to grow the game. It doesn't, closing a league doesn't mean to say nobody can come in, but it does mean to say you have to prove yourself as having a package that is sustainable in the long term. And not only that, you will, rather than London Welsh coming up and effectively being penalised for being an outsider, the Premiership didn't want them. They knew that there was no real virtue in having London and Welsh come up. Under the closed league system, strategic decisions are taken, and when a potential club is identified, not only are they welcomed into the fold, they are given extra resources to try to compete, because, you know, clearly it's harder to break into a thing like this than it should be for, you know, Leicester to carry on competing. If you've got a new club new to the table, they are going to need help. And this is an absolutely standard model in sports around the world. It's NFL. It works in Aussie rules. Rugby league in Australia. It's a normal thing to do. It's only really, well, football, which can get away with it because it's the only truly global sport and obviously fundamentally woven into the cultures of so many countries. So they can get away with it. But it's football's the only one, and you've got this sort of halfway house with rugby in England and France where they think they can sort of ape football, but they can't.
And it's the same with rugby league in this country as well, yeah. Exactly the same problem.
Yeah. Either way, you end up with the sort of gravitation of resources globally, and, you know, we've got similar questions facing the international game as well, obviously. When is the Six Nations going to either introduce relegation or just simply expand?
I would suggest never in terms of promotion and relegation.
Well, you say that. I mean, you were mentioning the book. It's very difficult with the book because so many... Irritatingly, so many crucial developments started to unwind at the beginning of this year, just as we were approaching the end of the writing process, which left us with some rather awkward decisions about what to do, to what degree could we go into, for example, the CVC deal with the Premiership or the World League of Nations or whatever they want to call it, the Tier 1 nations getting together to form a sort of annual competition. And in the end, we just decided not to try to second guess what was going to happen. And I think we've got away with it in terms of the book. It doesn't mean to say that it's just a good thing at all in terms of rugby more generally. We sort of had this awkward, on the one hand, for the good of rugby, you want one thing to happen, but then on the other hand, for the good of the book,
the journalist dilemma.
So we didn't want to look to write fatalistically about the way the game was going and then look rather stupid when World Rugby managed to convince all the Tier 1 nations, or rather the Six Nations, to open its arms to everyone else. In the end, of course, they haven't done that. And obviously today the news has broken that CVC are now buying into the Six Nations. We are led to believe they are also very close to a deal with South Africa. I mean, that is next. South Africa are coming up here, basically. They've already formed a bridgehead in the Pro 14.
Yeah, I think that's been on the cards for the last 5 or 6 years, hasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, at least. I mean, South Africa are in a real dilemma. You know, the start of professionalism, they and Australia and New Zealand, it was basically their gig. They were the teams of the moment. The North was no more than a sideshow. But then they've sort of watched in horror as the gathering monster, the economic monster, if you like, is starting to flex its muscles in England and France. And rather than looking across in mutual admiration to their friends in New Zealand and Australia, they're now looking solely up at Europe, which also happens to be in the same time zone. And if and when they jump ship and join the European rugby domestically and internationally, what does that mean for Australia? What does that mean for New Zealand? I mean, the outlook is bleak. Super Rugby's gone. The Rugby Championship is gone. The All Black jersey is no longer enough to keep the best players in New Zealand at home. And everyone, as we say in the book, everyone becomes essentially the Pacific Islanders. Because, I mean, that's what's happened to the Pacific Islanders, obviously. They are by far, and I absolutely do not apologise to New Zealand for saying this, they are by far the best rugby players on the planet. But they've got no economy. They are marooned in the big wide sea, and there's nothing they can do to stop all of their players following the money. And that's the way, you know, that's just in the nature
of professionalism, yeah.
Yeah. So what's the nature of the world? I mean, that's, you know, it's economic migration, essentially. And, you know, although I don't know whether Fiji haven't got a chance to do something this World Cup, but basically it's highly, highly unlikely any of Fiji, Samoa or Tonga will ever win the World Cup. But if they were a parallel universe where they kept all their players and they were properly prepared as much as, you know, the big beasts in international rugby are prepared, I should think they'd have won several World Cups by now. But, you know, and so New Zealand are in danger of heading down that road. If they can't, you know, keep a grip, they've done incredibly well, really. It's very difficult to explain how well they've done in the face of the economic onslaught, but it's going to get harder. And this CVC thing does not bode well unless the big countries can, big unions can somehow be persuaded, and CVC can be persuaded of the economic virtue in giving New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, but also, you know, Argentina, Italy, Japan, all of these countries who are sort of circling on the fringes, who could become something, unless these major unions are prepared to surrender some of their revenue to help, it's very difficult to see how this trend is going to be averted.
Yeah, and I think that's a problem with the CVC-style investments, because they're only interested in the bottom line. They have no loyalty to the culture or traditions of the game. And so everything will be done strictly on the bottom line basis. And well, whether in 10 years' time this will be looked back on as one of the worst decisions in the history of the game. Well, but I'm a historian, so I can't look forward. I can just tell you in the past. Well, that's true, yeah. I mean,
you know, the model is staring us in the face in football. You know, the international game is, I mean, obviously it's football so big that, you know, the World Cup is still a major event and so on. And I'm sure the World Cup of rugby will always be a major event. But the international game is completely subservient to the club game. And there's no, you know, that's not a cultural thing. That's the simple reality that when a sport turns professional, the people who provide a weekly diet of the action are the people, and also in the most populous, economically affluent areas, they are the people who end up running the show. That means, at the moment, the clubs of England and France. I mean, it could end up being some sort of pan-European / South African Super League. Whatever it ends up being, it's going to be gathered as things stand, as trends are going, it's going to end up centered around here. And the international game will sort of, well, they'll release all their players as and when there's an important qualifying tournament or whatever. You know, New Zealand will get their stars back here and there, a bit like, you know, the Pacific Islanders get their stars back a couple of weeks before, well, not even that really, a week in their case, before their first test of the series. That's the way international football works, more or less.
Yeah, and the power is within a small group. Yeah, small group of clubs in a small group of countries who are by and large always been in that position since the beginning of the 20th century. And I think that's where we're heading with rugby union. Yeah, and even South America's power is declining now because of the sheer economic power of European clubs.
And I mean, you know, the culture for football in South America, obviously, profoundly insinuated, that's never going. I mean, they'll keep on churning these players out. Well, one assume, I suppose you could argue that these trends might actually start to undo that, but it's difficult to see it at the moment. They will carry on producing these players, and they'll all, at the first opportunity, head off to Europe. But you know, they reflect sort of glory back onto their countries. But the point is, their homeland watches them from many thousands of miles away, you know, striding the big stage in Europe. And they get to have them back for, you know, the odd international fixture as and when. That'll be New Zealand if the current trends continue.
Yeah. Before long, and Australia as well, yeah.
Because Australia economically is a big country. I think we rank all these countries in the book, and I think they're 14th in the IMF list of economies. So they're a big player, but their rugby union is the fourth code of football, and a very distant fourth, really. And you know, Australia are interesting because they're the sort of really the test case for where rugby. I mean, all these issues about which rugby league wrestled with many years ago, they are absolutely poignant to Australia, because in Australia the sporting marketplace is brutal. And if, you know, your sport loses even just a few minutes through, for example, endlessly reset scrums, that is not just an irritation to be endured. That threatens the very sport itself, because people switch over in Australia. They love league and Aussie rules anyway. Increasingly, soccer's taking over Australia as well as, well, certainly as a sport to play. You know, they switch over. So Australia's always been in the vanguard of innovations. I mean, they were responsible for the experimental law variations of around about 08-09. They, of course, the Australian dispensation in the 60s, when, you know, they were allowed to play their own rules, their own laws, whereby you couldn't kick for touch directly unless you're in your 22. I mean, you know, it took...
Yeah, that was 40 years before it was before the IRB introduced it, yeah.
But, you know, for Australia, this was, you know, we cannot afford to drown in a sea of lineouts from people endlessly kicking to touch. We've got to up the pace here. And, you know, so they've always been sort of agitating ahead of the curve, if you like, to try and move things on. And it's even happening now with this global rapid rugby. I mean, that is really just another example of Aussies pushing the envelope, albeit in this case, you know, not endorsed by the union itself, perhaps, but it's the same dynamic. Andrew Forrest is trying to change the speed up and to break into new markets. And everybody wants to break Asia, you know, China and India, 1.5 billion people each, the money in the Middle East, all this sort of, you know, everybody would love to break Asia just as much as they'd love to break America. And it's not going to happen if rugby stays the way it is. Andrew Forrest knows this. He wants to inject, you know, pace into it. He doesn't want people sitting around watching reset scrums. And so he's changing the laws. And if rugby is going to break into a huge new market, it has to do that. It has to grab the attention in a way that it just has never really bothered to do in the past.
On that crucial note, we'll have to draw the interview to a close. I'd like to thank Mike. It's been a privilege to discuss the issues with you. Just to remind everyone, the book is called Unholy Union, When Rugby Collided with the Modern World by Michael Aylwin with Mark Evans, and it's published by Constable. And if you missed the first half of the interview, you can find it in episode 80 of Rugby Reloaded. If you want to follow Mike on Twitter, his name is at MDM Aylwin, and my name is @ColinsTony. If you want to dig a bit deeper into the history of rugby and the other football codes, take a look at the Rugby Reloaded website at www.rugbyreloaded.com. Until next week, thanks for listening.